You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
You guys are doing a great job. You're moving this line so fast, I can't believe it.
Well, you're here. We might as well keep you moving.
If you haven't been to a vaccination center by now, you probably know someone who has. The folks in line these days tend to be teachers or grocery store workers, chronically ill people, folks over 65.
Here's your ID back, and this is your vaccine card.
Okay.
Hold on.
California will open up COVID-19 vaccination centers to everyone in just about 2 weeks. But these days, sometimes you get somebody who doesn't fit into one of those currently eligible categories.
I got the appointment first and then got my food handler's card because it is just, it's an hour long, hour and a half long process. It's instantaneous, and you buy it through the website. I got mine for $7.95.
Gabe Fabricant used to work at a restaurant, but right now he's unemployed. He's 36 years old. Basically, he's at the back of the vaccine eligibility line. The vaccination centers will accept a food handler's card as proof of being a food or agricultural worker. Gabe hopped online, took a test, and then he got his shot.
Once I was comfortable knowing that supply was getting to the point where it was meeting or exceeding demands, it didn't feel like I was taking a spot away from someone who needed it.
KCRW's Kaylee Wells has the story of the people who are finding holes in LA County's vaccine system and figuring out how to get a shot early.
And do you have any allergies?
No.
Okay.
Gabe Fabricant wasn't trying to keep his plan secret. He actually took to Twitter, said he got a food handler's card to get the COVID-19 vaccine, and offered to help anyone else who wanted to jump the line.
When I say I can do it in sleep, it's because it's so easy to do. They ask like a 10 to 20 part multiple choice questions final at the end, and you have to get like 70% to achieve your card. And it's literally for dummies. It's like chicken must be cooked to 140 degrees, 165 degrees, 0 degrees. It's questions like that.
Ethical? Maybe not, but he's not the only one trying this. It turns out that jumping the line isn't that difficult. Since the county opened eligibility to people with certain health conditions, one method of proof is a self-attestation form where people can simply check a box saying they've got a condition and sign their name. That counts. Fabricant says he has his reasons. For one, he's not willing to try and get another job in food service until he's vaccinated. He was also suffering from panic attacks whenever he felt at risk of being exposed.
I just didn't feel safe without being vaccinated. I felt comfortable enough knowing I wasn't taking a vaccine away from someone who needed it.
So he rolled up to a CVS in North Hollywood after he got his card, didn't have to wait in a line, and got his first dose. The vaccinators told him a third of that day's appointments were no-shows. From the pharmacy, he texted me, saying any lingering guilt about cheating the system or jumping the line was completely gone. LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer says, frankly, people who are desperate to jump the line will find a way. And it's not helpful to bar some people who should get vaccinated to crack down on the people who shouldn't yet.
I never want anybody who's eligible to get vaccinated to not come forward and get vaccinated because they're worried that they don't have the correct document. That's why we're very flexible on the documentation.
It's the question of fast versus fair. The stricter the rules, the slower the rollout, and the more people die. Be more lax, and you reward the people who have the time to test for a food handler's card or the money for the internet connection to research the weaknesses in the system and score an appointment. As the vaccination effort drags on, LA County is leaning more into the latter. Just get the shots into arms and worry less about whose arms they are.
I don't really want to be spending all of our time trying to thwart that. Our goal is right now to make sure that there are absolutely no barriers to getting vaccinated for people eligible who live in hard-hit communities or who are members of racial or ethnic groups that are underrepresented in our vaccination efforts to date.
But prioritizing speed is good news for eager, affluent people looking to jump the line. When an Encino mom named Stephanie decided she would try and get the vaccine for her family before they were eligible, she had several friends suggest she just lie. Stephanie, by the way, has asked me not to use her last name since her method of getting vaccinated has been controversial. She drove to the historic South Central neighborhood of LA last week and stood outside of Kedron Health Center, hoping to get 3 expiring doses for her husband, and her 16-year-old daughter. She's since faced backlash as a white woman from an affluent neighborhood traveling to a primarily Latino, low-income neighborhood for a shot.
I feel like we have bigger fish to fry with people actually completely lying about it than to try to shame people and say, you're taking a vaccine away from somebody, you know, who lives in that community.
She says now that Kedron is prioritizing nearby zip codes, she thinks it's less likely that she's taking a shot from someone who deserves it. And she says if she were, say, 30, maybe she would have waited.
But I feel like I'm so close to it that why not try to get it if I can? I don't know. I could be making excuses for myself. Look, I really wanted one. So I was willing to go stand in line. If you want to try to get a leftover vaccination, you are going to be doing something that pisses somebody else off. I don't know. People want to be mad.
Besides, for every person who's bending a rule, there's someone who's breaking it.
I literally have friends who are like, oh, I was cross-country coach like last summer. I'll bring a pay stub from that. And they know they're doing it. They're like, I just want to get vaccinated.
Ann Kelly is a graduate student at LMU, and she's a TA, so her job is grading papers, taking attendance, all completely virtually.
My roommate said, oh, my friend's a TA, she's getting vaccinated. I didn't even know if that was, like, legal, but I was like, you know what, if other people are doing it, I'm going to do it, because I want to get my vaccine. It's kind of selfish looking back at it, but...
She made an appointment at the Cal State LA distribution site. She brought a pay stub. Nobody checked it.
The whole time I was going through the line, I was like, I wonder if they're going to kick me out because I'm just like a TA.
Kelly's beliefs of what's right and wrong don't necessarily line up with what she and her friends are or aren't willing to do to get vaccinated.
I understand that it's wrong, but I think at the same time, this is how America works. Like, if you can, you will. You can afford it, you'll get it. Or if you have connections, you'll get it.
Everyone has their reasons. For Kelly, it's her living arrangement and staying healthy for the final months of her NCAA career. For Fabricant, it's flying home for the first time in more than a year. And for Stephanie, it's being safe before her daughter goes back to high school.
I try not to let it bother me. I do what feels right to me, and it felt right to me, to try to get my family vaccinated.
All 3 of them are waiting on their second doses, and all 3 of them don't regret what they did to get their first. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. 5 years ago, California signed into law a bill mandating that the state create a high school ethnic studies curriculum. Well, this month, the Board of Education unanimously approved one, the nation's first ethnic studies curriculum. The goal is to increase understanding and respect among students and teach a history that focuses on the struggles and the cultures of often overlooked groups, specifically Black people, Latinos, Asians, and Indigenous Americans. The curriculum is a model, it's not a requirement for now, meaning school districts can decide whether or not to teach the material and then tailor it to their own student bodies. Talking about it with us today are a couple of people who've been thinking about and teaching ethnic studies for a long time now. Lisa Park, a professor and chair of Asian American Studies at UC Santa Barbara, and she co-directs the new program there to train educators on how to teach ethnic studies. Lisa, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Aviva Alvarez-Zaxson is someone who is not unfamiliar to our program. She's a regular, has been talking to us as a teacher. She teaches world history and ethnic studies at Hamilton High School here in Los Angeles. Aviva, welcome to you.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I want to start with you, Aviva, because you've been teaching ethnic studies for a little while now. How would you describe it for someone who's never heard of this subject?
So ethnic studies really is, when it's taught well, is really going to respond and reflect the student body upon which it is being taught to, and then teach students also about experiences, stories, and histories that have not always necessarily been highlighted in historical narrative. Now, for me, where I teach ethnic studies, I teach a one semester a ninth grade ethnic studies course. So it's not a lot of time. And it's with what I believe are very young students at the high school level. And so I really focus in on identity and helping students learn the vocabulary with which to articulate who they are, their experiences, and then also to articulate the different forms of oppression that they observe in the world and how to actively combat that and foster resilience within themselves in order to face that when they do in the world.
What do you think about this model curriculum being passed by the state and more schools implementing ethnic study programs?
Curriculum is always a bit interesting, and that curriculum always means that somebody has taken charge and somebody has created the narrative, if you will. And then it's kind of just used as a workbook for teachers to follow. So curriculum is always a kind of a complicated issue for me, because even looking at world history curriculum, I look at just the standards and it's either too broad, not specific enough, or doesn't highlight the right narratives. So there's always going to be issues with curriculum. But at the same time, I'm really, really glad that the state is pushing for all schools to teach ethnic studies. I think that that is an important, not first step, because people have been working towards this for decades, but it's a huge step.
Lisa, I want to bring you into the conversation now. You actually teach the adults who will teach the high schoolers. When this bill passed in 2016 to create a curriculum, what did you think at the time?
Well, first of all, I was impressed, right? I think that California is really at the forefront of something that's happening across the country. And for our state legislature to get together and to create a real impetus to encourage this kind of curriculum across the public school system, I was really impressed. And at the same time, we realized at the university level that here we are as ethnic studies faculty, right? This is our area of research. And yet there seemed to be a disconnect between what we're doing and what the work of folks like this incredible work that Aviva is doing, right? She's doing it in seemingly sort of on her own and creating in this incredible curriculum, which she's apparently doing an amazing job on her own. And we thought, well, what if there's a way to assist teachers like Aviva, right? And to use the research that we're producing at our own institution and have it be reflective of and learn from the work that's being done in the schools already, as well as to encourage other schools to do the same.
You and your colleagues over at UC Santa Barbara have created a program called Éxito, right? Which
yes.
is the word for success in Spanish. Tell mm-hmm. us a little bit about that program.
At UCSB, we happen to have the privilege of having these ethnic studies departments, along with a terrific graduate school of education. And so we thought, why not collaborate and help to train the teachers who are going to have to then teach these courses? The idea was we could have these kinds of state level mandates, but you know, then we thought, well, who's going to teach these courses, right? So we thought, well, let's take the resources that we already have, that we're already doing on this campus, let's get together and provide not only resources for those teachers who are like Aviva, who are already teaching these kinds of courses, but produce the students as well, the teachers, if you will, from the undergraduate level, and help them to get into graduate school of education to in order to teach these kinds of courses. And obviously, you know, these jobs are available or certainly increasingly will be available. And so we wanted to train our students who are already interested in teaching to go into this route.
Aviva, you're you know, over at Hamilton High doing this on the daily. I mean, obviously, this is a very sensitive subject, right? These are, I mean, very sensitive times that we're in right now. And I wonder, you know, what advice would you give to schools or teachers who are being asked to teach this material? I mean, is there a fear that it could be taught maybe the wrong way or maybe by the wrong teacher?
The advice I'd give to potential ethnic studies teachers is, if you want to teach ethnic studies, tell your admin that you would like to teach it, because that it helps to ensure that a passionate and excited teacher is the one given this course material. After that, seeking out support from places like this amazing program I'm hearing about from UCSB, just really seeking out resources to create a curriculum that's going to be best for their students, because the model curriculum is just that. It's a model curriculum. You can create a better version for your own students.
Do you think some teachers kind of roll their eyes at stuff like this? Or, you know, does that scare you that there's maybe a backlash? You know how politicized everything is these days.
I know some teachers roll their eyes because I've seen them do it at meetings, and it's okay. That's where passionate teachers come in, and you kind of just have to push through that. And then when it comes to the politicization of all of it, this idea of something being too political really, like, it comes from a point of privilege to be able to say someone's identity and experiences and histories and ancestors are political, because that it just, if you were to call my ancestors' existence political, then that and that thus cannot be studied. What does that say about your position and being able to study another person's ancestors?
How important do you think, Aviva, that it is that ethnic studies is taught by a person of color or somebody who does understand those histories?
I think it is important. I think that, though some people might disagree, I think that priority should be given to teachers of color. But I think that's also true to all subjects, really. And that's just simply because when students see themselves reflected in their teachers, it has a measurable success, has a measurable effect on success for those students. It just does, to see yourself reflected in the people who are teaching you. When it comes to ethnic studies specifically, it's not a requirement. I actually think it's good that people who are white take interest in this subject and believe that this subject is important. I do believe that having a teacher of color teach ethnic studies has a measurable impact, but is it an absolute requirement? Not necessarily.
Lisa, is that something you're thinking about as well over in Santa Barbara? Or how do you plan to recruit and support people of color, for that matter, people of all races who may be interested in teaching this kind of material?
We have a number of efforts going on here, and one of which, actually, we received the HSI funding from the Federal Department of Education to create, first of all, the teacher training program that I mentioned earlier, but also we're developing new programming as well as research and trying to enhance UCSB's teacher education program in order to encourage ethnic studies as part of the overall teacher training program period. This is fundamentally about improving the education of our students and providing this kind of ethnic studies knowledge, right, among our students, we know has incredibly positive impact for the classroom, for all students in that classroom.
Well, I want to thank you both for talking to us today about this. Lisa Park teaches Asian American Studies over at UC Santa Barbara. She's co-director of the Exito program that recruits and trains ethnic studies high school teachers. Aviva Alvarez-Axon, teaching world history and ethnic studies over at Hamilton High School here in LA. Thanks to you both for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Things, of course, are starting to open up in the art world. LACMA, the LA County Museum of Art, is opening its doors again tomorrow. No April Fool in there. Most galleries are open already. You just have to make an appointment ahead of time. So let's leave you today reflecting, literally reflecting, on the world through the lens of arts, piece by jagged piece. Lindsay Preston Zappas, founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, or CARLA, is a contributor here at Greater LA, and she's with us right now. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
A couple of shows to talk about today. Both sound, pretty interesting. Let's start with one called Shattered Glass. This is at the Jeffrey Deitch Gallery off Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood. Tell us about Shattered Glass.
Yeah, this exhibition is something. It's huge. There's 40 artists of color that are included in this work, mostly painting, but there are some sculptural works as well. And the exhibition really focuses on figuration and figurative works that kind of take up space in this really unapologetic way. Gosh, there's just such a range of styles and depictions of the human body. So it was honestly such a joy just to see so much painterly skill in one place and kind of the range of figuration. But a big goal of the show is also, of course, to point to racial inequities, right, within culture, but also within the art world itself.
One of the artists, Lindsay, featured at the show is a guy known as Mr. Wash.
Yeah.
he was given a life sentence for a nonviolent drug charge back in the late 90s. President Obama commuted his sentence and then granted him clemency 5 years ago.
Right.
What is his work like?
Yeah, I mean, his story is so amazing. And his work, I should also mention, is included in Hammer's Made in LA show, which is also opening soon to the public. So often, Mr. Wash is painting portraits of other people. And really, he's a storyteller. Like, he tells their stories through his painting. So sometimes it's family or friends or people he's met over the years while incarcerated. Sometimes they're famous celebrities or politicians. So there's a portrait of Kobe Bryant in this exhibition. A lot of Mr. Wash's portraits feature these really dimensional tears. This is something he's kind of known for, that stream down the subject's face and kind of stream down over the painting. So here, it's really quite emotional. We see these tears kind of coming from Kobe's eyes, and then they transform into these basketballs and basketball hoops. And they sort of end with this little vignette of Kobe kind of like throwing for a basket. So it really, it tells a story. And across the work, there's these smaller vignettes where Mr. Wash gives Kobe a kind of cracked texture on his skin. And then there's holes throughout that include little details like a family portrait or the scene after the helicopter crash. So he's really kind of building this picture throughout this portrait.
That crash obviously still fresh on a lot of minds here in Southern California, for sure. Well, we go from Fulton Leroy Washington to another artist, and this is a different kind of reflection, right? More metaphoric. Artist Ben Sakaguchi has a show at the Bellamy Gallery in Chinatown. He spent several years as a child in a Japanese internment camp in Arizona. This is obviously during World War II. Tell us about his show.
Yeah, wow. So his paintings are really gorgeous. They're very political, but they're styled in this kind of pop art aesthetic. So, you know, they seem kind of poppy and bright, and the depiction of the figures and different subject matter is really compelling. And so they draw you in and then reveal these much darker and more political themes. The main work in the show is this large piece called Chinatown that's made up of many small paintings that are kind of hung to create this larger tableau. And the work really charts out examples of violence and prejudice that have been enacted on the Asian American community kind of throughout American history, throughout the last couple hundred of years.
And tell us, Lindsay, more about the paintings themselves. I mean, what are they actually? I mean, you got really descriptive with Mr. Wash. What are these paintings like?
Yeah, so some of these paintings in this piece, Chinatown, some of them are showing early American propaganda posters that talk about Asian Americans as disposable labor. Another focuses on racist stereotypes that are portrayed in film and media. And then the central painting in this piece focuses on the Chinese massacre in 1871. And this was a lynching of 18 to 20 Chinese individuals in which no perpetrators were charged. So this just like really brings up so much of what we're experiencing today. And this took place in LA's old Chinatown where Union Station now sits.
Yeah, I mean, all this work obviously predates the shootings in Atlanta and the targeting of Asian Americans during the pandemic, too. So I can imagine the emotion that's evoked by all of this stuff. It's got to be just, you know, palpable.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't something new. And so this exhibition really points to this long history of xenophobia in our country.
A couple of timely shows for sure. One at the Jeffrey Deitch and the other at the Bellamy. Lindsay Preston Zapp is founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles and a regular contributor. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
A That's it for us today. Tomorrow, a venerable video spot in Santa Monica finds a new home in Eagle Rock, how it continues to specialize in living movie history. And opening day on the diamond for the Dodgers and the Angels. How's that going to work with people being allowed into the ballparks now? That's on the next episode of GLA. Join us online anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Get every episode delivered on the regular. Also, tell us how you're doing. Have you been fully vaccinated yet? If so, what's on the agenda? How will you be living your life differently than perhaps you have for the past year or more? Tell us at kcrw.com. Catherine Barnes, Rebecca Mooney, Sonia Geis, Jenna Cagle, Desmond Taylor, Phil Richards, John Meek, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis, honored by your presence. Thanks for your ear. Have yourself a great night.